Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take for a director or an actor to bring audiences to a deeper understanding of one of the best-known works in Western literature? William Shakespeare's harrowing tragedy, King Lear, has been performed almost constantly since its debut in 1606, thanks in part to the ever-relevant questions it poses about aging, power, betrayal, madness, and familial and political loyalty. The story that covers the chaos that ensues when the elderly King Lear plans to divide his kingdom among his three daughters, with the greatest share going to the one who most fervently declares her love for him, never anticipating that the daughter who truly cares most will find herself unwilling and unable to declare her affection with empty words. The Dallas Theater Center's current production of King Lear, now through February 17th at the Wiley Theater, marks the fourth and final play in a four-season Shakespeare cycle that began in 2009 with A Midsummer Night's Dream. Kevin Moriarty is artistic director of the Dallas Theater Center and director of King Lear. Actor Brian McElhaney plays the title role. Brian and Kevin, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So clearly you are both intimately familiar with this work and have been for some time. What is your process for reading through it once again, looking back at source material and research material in order to develop ideas for this particular production?
Well, as a director, I started in this case probably a year and a half ago, or in some ways, I guess you could say 25 years ago when I very first encountered the text and have thought about it extensively since. But in preparing for the production, I spent about a year and a half reading the play, reading commentary about the play. Commentary is the few surviving documents from Shakespeare's time that give us a fragmentary sense of how it was received and how it was produced, all the way up through each century until we get to today. And critical commentary has changed quite a bit, as has the way that the piece has been produced and seen on stage. Even the ending had about a 100-year period in the 1700s and the early 1800s where it had a happy ending, was regularly produced for 100 years with a happy ending, which is not the way Shakespeare wrote it. But all of that commentary, the ideas, the intellectual insights ultimately have to lead to a series of choices about the sets, the costumes, the casting, the specific cutting of the text for the play that is going to translate some sense of what's at the heart of this play today for a modern – for me reading the play. What, after reading all that stuff, what, how does the play speak to me? Why does it matter deeply to me? Why will it matter deeply to our community? And what are those choices we can make that will make that come immediately alive in real time for an audience?
I had a long history with the play. I've played The Fool before. I played Edgar before in younger incarnations of myself. I've taught the play a lot as an acting teacher. So I knew the play fairly well. I didn't kind of go to the scholarly sources that Kevin went to, because you don't want to come in with too many aesthetic choices as an actor. But I did think about the play a lot. I went through 10 years of rather difficult aging process with my parents, who are now deceased, so I can talk about them in public. And a lot of my experience and thinking about the play was based on their experience and my experience with them. And I came in basically knowing the lines, but left it open to Kevin to see what he was going to do with it. And then, so I thought about it basically on a human level as opposed to a production level.
Well, I think ultimately when you're creating a play, that you're looking for a marriage of those two things. That, in other words, even while reading all the scholarly commentary, like Brian has said, there are also those moments where you confront in yourself thoughts and experiences, deep wells of emotion about parents, about children, about relationships that you've had. I have my stepfather right now is suffering from the early stages of Alzheimer's. And though in no way is the production a comment on that or meant to represent that in some way, it's impossible to do a play about an 80-year-old father and leader who is confronting questions of who he is in relation to the world around him, his diminishing sense of power, ultimately for King Lear in the play, a descent into homelessness and madness. It's impossible to do that and not have your own connections with your own sense of parents and family. And it's really inside of those two things, the ideas that Shakespeare gives us and the personal experiences that we all have in making the play, that we hope that'll come together and translate for an audience to unlock those things in themselves as well.
One thing that occurred to me, Kevin, is that although so many of the themes are really universal, they are timeless, the one thing that is unquestionably different is that today we have a very scientific understanding of dementia and of mental illness. And we can talk later, I guess, about whether this Lear is more a victim of dementia or of mental illness or a combination. But how did you sort of square what we now know about the way the brain works and the diseased brain works with the assumptions that were made at the time that Shakespeare was putting this story down?
Well, I think it's true. Our understandings are very, very different. And in the rehearsal process, we did not spend a lot of time trying to create a scientific or psychologically understood portrait of the characters. There are characters who do unspeakably evil things in the play. There are characters who grapple with end-of-life issues and madness. There are characters who do all sorts of marital infidelity, all sorts of things that our understanding of now is very, very, very different mm-hmm. in terms of the causes and the impact than what Shakespeare would have known. But what is true is that Shakespeare was observing human life as it was. He was observing people who, during his time period, were no longer in control of their own sense of power, their own understanding of themselves, their own identity, themselves of their relationship to their families. And I think that accurate representation of what people were experiencing or going through hasn't changed much in 400 years.
Absolutely not. It's one of the reasons that Shakespeare is such a great writer, not just a great poet, but a great dramatist, is that he understood human life and human nature and created in all of his plays characters that you say, oh my God, it's just like that. You read this play, certainly in my experience, you look at all of those scenes in that first half and you say, it was just like that. The rages, the uncontrollable rages, has nothing to do with Alzheimer's, or it may have something to do with Alzheimer's, but it certainly has something to do with the loss of power, the rage at losing your power, not being in total control. He was looking at life mm-hmm. and writing what he saw. Just because we have a different scientific understanding of it doesn't mean that life has changed. Old people are old people.
Yeah, and part of that in King Lear that's so powerful is you have a king who is a father who is essentially never questioned who he is. He knows exactly who he is. He knows who he is as a man. He knows who he is as a father. He knows who he is as a leader. And he knows what his country is. And those things are strong and powerful and dynamic and true. And he is, and nobody questions him. And therefore, what he's known his whole life is that he is always right.
Yeah.
He says at one point early in the play a line to the extent of, I have never changed my mind about anything. And what happens to that character when at 80 years of age he decides to no longer retain the power of king and gives over his property and to his adult daughters? So now his relationship to them as a father, his relationship to everyone around him as a leader is very, very different for the first time ever at 80 years of age. Mm-hmm. And that forces the question ultimately of, if I'm not a king, if I'm not a father, if I'm not an all-powerful being who I thought I was, then who am I? Mm-hmm. And when you get to 80 years of age and you realize you don't know who you are, for Shakespeare, that created in his character a crack in his psyche. Now, we may understand that in different ways. I mean, to Shakespeare, that leads to madness ultimately. But and simultaneously, a moment, a touch, a glimmer of deeper understanding of the essential quality of being human. But certainly for all of us, we understand as people in the modern world what it is as those we love, or even those of us ourselves as we get older, what that experience is of saying everything I've known about myself in relation to those around me is being shaken.
Brian, did you think for yourself, did you sort of in your mind create a kind of prologue for Lear so that you could imagine him when he was, say, 50, truly at the height of his power physically and politically? Because we don't see that in the play.
We don't see any of it in the play. So yeah, I think something about it doesn't help really to – it doesn't help me to make up mythic or to make up stories. I just – it's – you know, I look at what is there and use what I know in life. What is it like to be a leader? What is it like to be somebody who spent all his life in charge? And we – all of us are in charge of something and get what that is and to feed off the love of others and the respect of others. You know, I'm a teacher as well as an actor and, you know – you know, we are all narcissistic to some extent. We all kind of use that in our lives. My students love me. My family loves me. My audience loves me. The people who work for me love me. And what is it to be that kind of ruler? It's kind of clear. You know, the only evidence we have is the family. Those daughters.
Something was amiss there.
Something was amiss in that family. Mm-hmm. There was some kind of abuse of power in that family. And I've certainly tried to incorporate that into my understanding of how it works and why they are so, well, some people say evil. Some people – but certainly not caring mm-hmm. about their father. Something was amiss in that family. And so I used what I knew about that.
Actor Brian McElhinney plays King Lear. Kevin Moriarty is artistic director of the Dallas Theater Center and director of the production that runs at the Wiley Theater through February 17th. If you would like to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372. Right now, though, we would like to ask you to help us to wrap up this fundraising campaign. Give us a call at 1-888-694-6931 or go online to KERA.org and make your contribution there. I think, Jeff, we have a special goal today, and if we do, we will do very well for the station.
Chris, Julia Pendry has made a challenge.
Thank you, Julia.
She is a listener and supporter of KERA. She will donate an additional $1,000 to the station if 125 listeners will make a donation today to support Think, which is her favorite show, she says.
How nice.
She's a supporter who credits KERA with helping her become a good citizen of the world. So make your call right now to 888-694-6931 or contribute at KERA.org. Help us meet this challenge. We've got to hear from 125 contributors by 2 p.m. today. Please don't wait. Please do it right now.
Many of you like to wait till the last day or maybe the second to last day. We are hoping that we are there. So please, once you make your call or your online contribution, let everybody else know that you've done it. Sometimes your friends may think, well, nobody I know gives to KERA. And if they find out you do, that might inspire them to do the same thing. Your contribution goes to work for you 365 days a year, 24 hours a day. You never turn on 90.1 and find nothing. In fact, you find useful information. You find news, you find some entertainment programming. We are always here to serve you, but we rely on the dollars that you send to the station.
And we're discussing, of course, King Lear today. And we have an offer for you that also brings in a little bit of royalty and maybe a little taste of the feudal system and certainly
lords. Got an evil gleam in your eye.
Lords and ladies. Well, I'm the Mrs. Patmore to your Lady Edith.
Chris. I'm Lady Edith.
I don't know.
Lady Edith is Jan Brady.
Are you Lady Mary?
I don't know. I think I want to be Matthew Crawley's mother.
Really?
I'm not Lady Mary.
Mrs. Crawley? Wow. Well, I'll be Mr. Carson then. How's that? So what are we talking about? If you know what we're talking about.
If you don't happen to watch, yes.
Yes. If you know what we're talking about, you're going to be really excited by the 3-season DVD offer of Downton Abbey. Yes.
Yeah. We will give you all 3 seasons worth of DVDs as a thank you gift when you make a contribution of $20 a month. You can do it in one lump sum if you want, $240, but $20 a month is really easy. If you would like to make your contribution now, you can do this online at KERA.org, or you can call 1-888-694-6931.
I would be lying if I said that this was not hugely popular in the last few days. So get your copies of Downton Abbey, do it online at KERA.org, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with actor Brian McElhaney, who plays King Lear in the Dallas Theater Center production of King Lear, and Kevin Moriarty, who is director of the production and artistic director of the Dallas Theater Center. You can see the play through February 17th at the Wiley Theater. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I sort of like thinking about this, that in his day, would they have called it like William Shakespeare's King Lear? Because the story was not his originally.
The story wasn't his. It was a well-known story. In fact, it was several well-known stories because there are two essentially interlocking plots in King Lear, that of King Lear's family and that of the Earl of Gloucester's. So the audience, as far as we know, would have arrived at the theater well, knowing the plot pretty well. Shakespeare did a couple things to the plot that are quite different than the existing source material his audience would have known. He added some characters of his own invention. The Fool, for instance, as far as we know, is a singular character inside of that story. And he adjusted the plot in some significant ways. Spoiler alert, the King Lear is a tragedy, and it ends with one of the most sorrowful, senseless acts of destruction one can imagine, where at the very end of the play, Cordelia is murdered seconds before the order is given to save her life, and characters go rushing off stage to save her, but it's too late. That was not in the source material. When Shakespeare's audience arrived on opening night, the story they knew was that just before Cordelia was going to be killed, the message was given, go save her. They rushed off stage, the servants did, and they came back on stage with a living Cordelia. So for Shakespeare's audience on opening night to have that expectation of a story where the possibility of grace and redemption and divine intervention – to have that suddenly ripped away from them would have been almost incalculably upsetting.
Why do you think, Brian, that Cordelia remains loyal to Lear even after he's, you know, denied her her inheritance, banished her, essentially because she didn't – and I'm oversimplifying but she, essentially because she doesn't lie to him and say things that might ring false?
Shakespeare doesn't really explain it, but I think what the play says is that she loves him and that love involves forgiveness. And the other story, Edgar does the same to his parent, Gloucester, who believes the worst of him, tries to have him murdered. He sticks by his, in this production, mother. And Kent, the same thing, banishment. There is a trope of people who are mistreated by the people they love and yet still love them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very powerful part of the story, I think.
It's one of the great mysteries, I think, of life even today is that we have people in our families, we have people in our lives who stand by you and with you to the very, very end, even people who are treated badly. And there are people who seem like they are such a deep part of your life, who at some moment in your life you think, I love them the most, or they would never leave me. And then you discover in moments of crisis or when circumstances change, power dynamics change, that that they abandon you or turn against you. I think that must have been as mysterious and upsetting to Elizabethans as it is, frankly, for us today.
Yeah, I mean, you hear the phrase, they had a falling out. You know, people were really close and then something happens and they fall apart. In this play, three major figures have that falling out and then still stay loyal and go through a lot of personal hardship to keep the connection.
If you've ever, you know, visited a home for older people, it's striking to see the people there who every day someone comes to visit. And the people there who are essentially abandoned for months or even years on end. My grandmother, when she was in a nursing home near the end of her life, had a roommate who was placed next to her in a room who in all of the time that we would visit my grandmother, my mother visit her every single day, in all of that time we never saw anyone visit the woman in the bed next to my grandmother. Mm. And there's, you know, there's a story behind every one of those things, and many of them are stories that you never know from the outside, but even sometimes you don't know from the inside. Mm-hmm. That I think for King Lear, if you ask him in the first scene, he absolutely clearly believes that these two daughters who he's giving his property to, he's giving his power to, he says, all I want now is to live with one of you for 1 month and then go live with the other you, one of you for another month and then back to the first. I'm going to live with you and all I want is 100 knights, servants, 100 servants to be kept with me, and I want to be able to kind of be treated right. And he doesn't even make it a month before he's abandoned and cast out.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a legal term in the play that he uses toward the end of that first half. He says, I made you my guardians, which is a legal term that we use, that they abuse, that is often abused in life. It strikes me very, very hard when I use that word.
There's also a poignancy, I think, to Lear's sense that even though he is old, even though in the best of circumstances he knows his life is coming to an end, he still wants to control his own legacy.
Completely.
And he says, I'm handing it over to you, but he doesn't really mean that. He doesn't really mean I am in your care. He means, okay, you're going to take me in and I'm going to sort of direct the future of things. And I think that's a really interesting emotion may be the wrong word, but a set of feelings and a set of behaviors that I think probably a lot of people can relate to.
Absolutely. It's certainly something that I've learned from working on this play, that you can't engineer the terms of your own retirement. It's going to happen somehow, and you can't control it, and you can't control all the things that you think you can control. Thematically, he doesn't only think that he can control that. He thinks he can control the universe, all that cursing, that, speaking to the gods, speaking to the heavens, hurling these curses. He thinks he's in charge, and the universe is in charge of him, and that's a big thing he finds out. It's a big turn in the play that he realizes that he's just not in charge of anything he thought he was in control of, and that's a big turning point in the human journey. Learning that we're not in control of so many things.
And Brian's point there, I think, is part of what makes this play so truly one of the greatest works of Western art, is that the play exists on three levels simultaneously. So not only is Lear trying to maintain control of a family when he no longer has that power over his daughters, the same thing is happening in his kingdom, where at some level he believes that he can continue to maintain control over the country itself. And he can't. The country descends into civil war. And ultimately that extends all the way up to the heavens itself, that over and over and over again in King Lear, characters invoke a greater power. It's set in an ancient pre-Christian time, so they call them the gods, plural. But over and over and over again, they invoke the gods to do their command, to help them in their time of need, and they are met with a resounding silence throughout the entire play. I think that sense, that desire for humans to control the world, their country, the circumstances around them, their family, that desire for power, that spreads throughout all the Shakespeare plays and perhaps throughout human existence, but also the knowledge, the awful tragic knowledge that ultimately we are not in control. We do not have power over who loves us, over how the world that we live in exists, or even over our own lives and deaths.
And there's an interesting resonance too, I think, in with the storm and that sense that we don't have power over nature, and we in this very wealthy country sense that our technology can protect us from the things externally that might harm us. And as we have learned to our peril over the past decade or so, these things come through, and it really humbles everyone, the people who are directly affected and also the people who were supposed to have protected us from these terrible events.
The moment that touches me the most deeply in the whole entire play is by the time the king has lost his power, the father has lost his relationship with his daughters, and the man himself doesn't know who he is. He's going mad. He's thrust out into a storm, naked and homeless. And in that storm, for the first time in his life, he looks out and starts to think about the other naked, homeless beggars who are outside on the heath. Mm-hmm. And he realizes that when a king, a father, a man is stripped of the robes and the power and all of that, when you're naked and alone outside, one man is exactly the same as another. What ties everyone together is a very basic level of humanity. And he looks out and realizes this and says, I have taken too little care of this. And I think that's a great moment of revelation for the character and a deep moral sense of the play, is that there are these invisible ties that tie together families and nations and even our own psyches. And if you don't tend to them and nurture them and honor them, you risk, you put at peril your life, your family, and the world.
Another interesting change in this production is that, of course, you have the Earl of Gloucester played by a woman, Phyllis Kay. And historically, for obvious reasons, because part of the plot hinges on Gloucester having a legitimate and an illegitimate son, it has always been played by a man. I thought it was interesting, and I know people either love this or they hate it. I found, as a working parent in a kind of an egalitarian relationship, I found it simply to not... I didn't find that it didn't make any sense to me. I think our understanding now of the ability for a man to be tender with his children, the way that a woman is tender with her children, has really expanded. And it doesn't need to exclusively be a man. But maybe you can talk about how both of you thought about this when the decision was made.
Well, I'd say three things. At some level, you have a great roles, and there are a lot of great actresses of a certain age who it just feels—
who don't get enough work.
Yeah, exactly. You know, there's a practical part and a thematic part. Thematically, for me, there's the idea that Lear is a father. He has three daughters, and you watch that simultaneously while you're watching, in our production, a mother and her two adult sons. And I like the balance of that, and how those stories reflect and refract off of each other. But I also think that Shakespeare's audience would have absolutely understood that a woman could be powerful, loving, cruel, all of those things that Gloucester is, because their queen was Queen Elizabeth, and she was very, very powerful, respected, dynamic, strong, all those things. However, Shakespeare's theater, he was not allowed to have women or girls appear on his stage. That was illegal. So the female roles he wrote had to be played by prepubescent boys in drag. Now, as somebody who makes theater for a living, often with kids on stage in shows like Christmas Carol and Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, I love having kids on stage. But if you have the choice of having a complicated, psychologically astute role being played by a prepubescent boy or a professional adult male actor, I strongly encourage you to hire the professional adult right. male actor. It just makes learning the lines and rehearsing the play easier. Shakespeare was a man of the theater. I think if Shakespeare was writing today and he had access to adult skilled women at his arsenal, as, say, Molière did in France just 100 years or so later, I think you would have certainly seen families in his plays balance out in these kind of ways.
Kevin Moriarty is artistic director of the Dallas Theater Center, which has the current production King Lear on stage at the Wiley Theater through February 17th. We're also speaking this hour with actor Brian McElhaney, who plays King Lear. We'll come back to our conversation with them in just a few minutes. If you'd like to ask a question, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send your thoughts via email to think@kera.org. We are joined in studio once again by Jeff Whittington, who is the senior producer of Think and host of Anything You Ever Wanted to Know. Jeff told us in the last break about the challenge we have running that we're very excited about. We're looking for 125 contributions over the 2 hours of Think today, and we will receive $1,000.
That's right. Julia Pendry will donate an additional $1,000 to KERA if 125 listeners will make a donation today in support of Think. It's her favorite show, and she's a supporter who credits the station with helping her become a good citizen of the world. Well, here's an update. We've heard from a few of you. 111 contributions left to go, either on the phone at 888-694-6931 or click and join at kera.org. I want to thank Richard Waddington in Fort Worth, probably a long-lost relative of mine. Thanks, Richard. Suzanne Leslie in Dallas, Phyllis and Gwen Morton in Garland, and Daryl Gellander in Dallas. Thanks so much to each of you for supporting the station.
Thank you, Farah Kahalnick and Michael Cohen in Dallas, Robert Fix in Coppell, Leroy Rodriguez in Arlington, and Steve Gass in Dallas. Really appreciate you taking action today. We hate to leave these challenges on the table. And the great thing about them is that when the momentum is going and there's just a few people left to go, there is a certain subset of the public radio contributing population that just can't do it until they feel like they're in the last 10. So if you are not in that subset and you could be moved to do it now and help us to receive this additional $1,000, we would really appreciate you making that call so that we can sort of unlock the power of those last few.
Well, 110 left to go. So let's just say 10 in that case and get you to call
888-694-6931
or click and join at kera.org. Don't forget, we've got a couple of Downton Abbey related things for you. We started talking about this $10 a month contribution. It's $120 for the year, and we would thank you with season 3, the currently airing PBS masterpiece season of Downton Abbey. It's not even finished airing yet, but we've got season 3 on DVD for $10 a month contribution. And then we were looking at the list, and it said for a $20 a month contribution, we'd give you seasons 1, 2, and 3. Seems like an accounting mistake, but this is your chance to take advantage of that if it is indeed so. It's not really an accounting error, but we're offering you all 3 seasons of Downton Abbey on DVD for like $20 a month,
yeah,
which is a pretty great deal, yeah, when you consider that you also get KERA every day.
Yes, absolutely. Your contribution really pays for this great radio. You're not buying the seasons of Downton Abbey, although it would not be a half bad deal if you were buying them for that amount of money. But this really goes to support this station that can't exist without your support. The idea of public radio, we don't wish that we could sell commercials. And I mean, sometimes it would be easier maybe, but it was never set up to do that. We've always wanted to speak directly to you, to serve you and what you want. I can tell you this is a fantastic conversation, one of my favorite interviews of, I would say, the quarter. This would not sell on a commercial radio station for an hour. I see Kevin nodding his head. You might get 2.5 minutes on the morning news, and there would be some, you know, recipes along with it. There's nothing wrong with
that. I have a recipe.
But some in-depth...
I'm kidding.
But some in-depth conversations are the things that exist in the broadcast sphere only on public radio. And in North Texas, that means only on KERA. Please make your call of support now at 1-888-694-6931 or do it online at kera.org.
What will happen to Mr. Bates? Well, you can find out when you get your season 3 of Downton Abbey. You get all 3 seasons for a $20 a month contribution. Call 888-694-6931 or click and join at kera.org. Thanks to our guests for enduring these 2 membership breaks. We're going to be right back with more of this conversation in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the Dallas Theater Center's Artistic Director, Kevin Moriarty, who is also director of the production of King Lear, which continues at the Wiley Theater through February 17th. Brian McElhaney is here as well. He is the actor who plays the title role. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. And we have Nicole on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Nicole.
Hi there. I was wondering if either of the guests had seen a couple of foreign film adaptations of Shakespeare where the plays were really deeply transposed into other cultures. I'm thinking in particular of Ron by mm-hmm. Akira Kurosawa, which they probably know. And then the other one is an adaptation of Othello by an Indian filmmaker, Vishal Bharadwaj, and it's called Omkara.
I'm familiar with Ron, but not with the Indian Othello. It's great to keep reminding ourselves that, you know, there's no one way to do these plays, that every culture, every time, appropriates the plays and makes them their own. In our own language, we have a much closer relationship to the plays, but the plays are done all over the world in different languages and, as you say, in film in different mediums. And that's important to know, to take ownership and say we have to do something with this play that's ours as opposed to doing it the right way, whatever that means.
One of the many interesting things Kurosawa did in Ron, which is truly a masterpiece in its own right, he transposed the three daughters of King Lear to being three sons. So there's a gender shift, but in a very different way, though impactful in the ancient Japanese world that he was portraying in the film.
We have an email here from Tom in Wichita Falls who wants to know, why does the fool abandon Lear? The character simply disappears halfway through. I should say he doesn't entirely disappear in this production.
Yeah, well, that was something this was something that has become a major issue for a subset of 20th century literary criticism about King Lear, and very much so for theater directors in productions. At the point, there became a point in the mid-20th century after World War II where this was remarked upon a lot, that the fool just stops having lines. He doesn't – I mean, the script doesn't say what happens to him. He just doesn't have any more lines in the second half of the play, quite possibly just because Shakespeare didn't have a need to put funny lines in at a certain point in the tragedy. I don't really know why. But it's become in theater tradition now, most 20th century directors have staged relatively gruesome onstage deaths for the fool, trying to explain why he's no longer speaking in the play. In some productions, Lear, in a fit of madness, stabs and kills the fool. In others, he's killed by a member of Goneril's army. When we started rehearsing the play, I just assumed that we would kill the fool. And we, in fact, staged it that way. We had a character, a servant of Goneril's, strangle him and dispose of his body. And we practiced it. We had fake blood and all the rest of that stuff. And then at a certain point in the process, the creative process, it seemed to me that that felt like we were just adding carnage on top of carnage, and that was a late 20th century response to the genuine deep bleakness of the play, but it just didn't feel true. It felt self-consciously nihilistic. And so I said to the actor playing the fool, well, what if you stay alive? And at first, he just quietly stood in those scenes watching King Lear. And over time, what we've discovered is that his presence, his very few moments of focus, and we've taken one or two lines from earlier in the play and grafted them into the later part now. That presence is another reminder of the people who stand by us to the end, the people who presumably have been lifelong friends, the people whom you joke with or call on their bad behavior, who even at the very end, even when you don't recognize them, I mean, even when you may be in final stages of dementia, who are still there. And I think that there's an inescapable truth that the dead body of Cordelia is a reminder of the despair and darkness in the world as Lear himself dies. But I also think there's an equally important truth that there is silently genuflecting at the side of Lear's body as he expires from the earth. There's the fool as well. And so in our production, we've chosen not to kill him, even though at least for a while in rehearsal, we enjoyed doing damage to him.
Brian, how do you manage your energy over what amounts to 3 hours? And are you doing two a days on weekends?
Sometimes. Yeah. I did two yesterday. It's rather taxing, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it's not even just through the whole day. It's through the production that you really have to muster so much energy. Do you work out in a certain – is there a King Lear, like, fitness video or something?
No.
I mean, how do you –
Well, Laurence Olivier once said that the most important characteristic that an actor has to have is stamina. And I think that's true. There is a definite athletic quality to what we do in live stage acting. That, you know, you have to start at a high, high pitch, and then almost 3 hours later, you're still going at that high pitch. And there does take a certain amount of training to do it, vocal and emotional and mental, just as athletes do. I do run I run outside the play as well, but usually 2 hours before we get to the theater, I run for about 3 miles just to get myself ready and warmed up so that I'm there. When I don't do that, I have trouble staying present. You have to come in ready to do something big. It's a big play.
Is it something you ever worry about just in general with your actors, or knowing that you work with professionals, is it something you just can take for granted?
I'm lucky at this point in my life as a director that I can basically assume that experienced professional actors are going to be able to have the vocal and physical stamina to be able to do almost anything that you request of them.
That willingly.
Yes, very much so. And that's a luxury, I have to say, at a certain point in one's career in the professional theater. Yeah. Certainly when I'm teaching and working with high school students, college students, or young professionals, that actually does become a big issue. When you're working with young actors, even young stars, you know, people in maybe even in their early 20s, you'll sometimes get to performances where they say, oh, I was a little tired today, or oh, I stayed out too late last night, or oh, I just wasn't feeling it today. Mm-hmm. And it takes some firm and immediate conversations about one's obligation, which is
together.
To bring absolutely everything you have to the stage every single time. And that's challenging.
Yeah, as someone who trains young actors, I mean, lots of people are very talented, but not lots of people are willing to actually do what it takes
to be a
professional.
That's the difference, right, between success and talent.
Absolutely. And, you know, anybody can act well when they're feeling good. It takes a professional to act when you have 102 fever, or you have a migraine, mm-hmm. or somebody has just died in your family, or you're having fights with your loved ones, or you just don't feel like it. I mean, that's when the professionalism kicks in, and you just have to pull yourself together and do it at the height of your powers for 3 hours.
Do you ever ask yourself why that's more important than those other things that you mentioned?
Oh, that way lies madness.
You know what I'm saying? That, like,
absolutely.
That need, that drive to do art is something that I think people outside that world can't always fully understand, especially when it,
yes.
it ultimately is destructive in some ways.
It's consuming.
Uh-huh.
And it's the reason we do it without a lot of financial or personal or a lot. We don't get a lot of rewards. We
right.
have some rewards.
Mm-hmm.
It's a glamorous, fun way to live. But it's also difficult in a world that, you know, where money is the the key to American success. We don't make a lot of money. And the reward is the work. And so the only way you get full reward from the work is to devote yourself entirely to it. And the less you if you don't give it 100%, it's not worth doing.
You also
I totally get that.
it's a little hard to explain, but I have some sense that when I'm devoting all of my energies and all of my focus into a creative project, that there is the genuine, real possibility that I'm going to figure something out, that I'm going to touch on some moment that makes sense to me about myself, about the people around me, about the world. I mean, maybe even as silly as this may sound, maybe even touch on an existential truth about mm-hmm. life. And there's a great pleasure in tunneling out everything else and just focusing on that moment, which sometimes could be a moment of light or a sound cue, a prop, and usually as a human being. Usually it's about just spending 8 hours a day watching an actor in a rehearsal room and trying with all of your energy to kind of enter into what they're doing to find that moment that you can pull out or celebrate or change in some way to get to something deep. And that pursuit is unbelievably rewarding, kind of like when you're solving a crossword puzzle and you're really, really in the zone.
Yeah.
Or you know, when you're onto something, you're kind of in the hunt. That's very, very rewarding. And much of the rest of the moments in our lives, however glorious they are, we don't necessarily feel that we're getting close to an answer of some kind. We often feel that we're just getting farther and farther into the questions.
And that's the director. Sorry, that's the director's creative process. Then the play opens and the director leaves, and we get to do it. We have to do it, but I like to say we get to do it 8 times a week, and which is a lot. And try every time to make it better and deeper and fuller, knowing that there's somebody out there. A child, an old person, a parent, anyone who will be touched by this, changed by this. And so you have a responsibility to give 100, 110%. And if you don't, you shouldn't be doing it.
Actor Brian McElhaney plays King Lear in the Dallas Theater Center production that runs through February 17th at the Wiley Theater. Kevin Moriarty directed the production, and he is artistic director of the Dallas Theater Center. It's been a pleasure to have you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks to all of you who are listening today. Thanks especially to those of you making contributions so that we can hopefully receive this wonderful challenge grant that we have. We are really waiting to hear from you at kera.org or 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org. We're about to have an update. We need 125 contributions by the end of the second hour of the show today in order to receive this wonderful challenge grant that we have been offered. And your call right now can get us that much closer. We have 103 calls to go. Really need to step it up in this second hour, and you can make a significant difference now by making a contribution in any amount. 1-888-694-6931 is the number. Jeff Whittington has stepped into our studios now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. Yes, 888-694-6931 is indeed the phone number. You've heard us say it all week, and if you've waited till today, well, you can have a huge, huge impact today on helping us stay on track to try to wrap this drive up by tomorrow evening. I mean, that's our ultimate goal was originally today, but it looks like we could maybe do it by tomorrow if we can raise if we can garner these 103 remaining calls or online contributions by 2 p.m. And Chris, as you mentioned, there is a $1,000 challenge on the table from Julia Pendry. She wants to challenge you to make 125 contributions this hour and next to support Think, which is her favorite show. Thank you very much, Julia. And
thank
she
you.
Credits KERA with helping her become a good citizen of the world, and she wants to make sure that it's available here for you and for everyone else.
You know, we talk a lot about our goals, and we talk about our goal for the next, for the 2 hours of Think Today. When we say our, we don't just mean my goal and Jeff's goal and Shelley Canavy's goal and Jeff Ramirez's goal and Rick Holter's goal, those of us who work here. We are also talking, when we say our, we mean it's your goal too, because we know you are invested in the station. We know that you turn to it on a regular basis to learn, to explore the world around you, to have up-to-date and high-quality information that has been filtered through really the finest journalistic practices. We want to make sure that we don't report things to you until we know that they are true as of the information that is most current. Your support makes quality journalism possible. If you have ever lamented that, you know, the media has become sort of a sinkhole of garbage and of information that doesn't really matter, this is the place that we know you turn for respite from that. But it doesn't happen for free. If we could all make it exist, if we could all have public radio exist with no cost, no effort on our part, no salaries to pay, no programs to pay for, we would love to be able to do that. But we all know that's not the way the world works. So your contribution to the station right now is your contribution to a world in which quality journalism exists and particularly is set up to serve you here in North Texas.
888-694-6931 is the number to call. Again, 103 contributions remaining to make this challenge. Really do need to hear from you. It may have seemed like we're talking to other people all week long, but today we're talking to you. We really do need to hear from you this hour and or next to make this challenge. We can't leave this $1,000 and this very generous gift from Julia Pendry on the table. Call now, please, 888-694-6931. Or if you're already online, maybe you're at your desk, maybe you listen while you're at work, you're already on the computer, you can surf over to kera.org and you can make your contribution there at the Safe and Secure support page.
Everyone who is a current donor to this station was once like you. They listened. They liked the station. They weren't quite sure if we really meant them, if we were really asking them for a contribution. They weren't quite sure if their modest contribution would make a difference. And then they decided, you know what, I'm going to go for it because this is something I believe in. And frankly, it's a not-for-profit whose services I draw on every day. If you have the position to help a not-for-profit organization provide you with a service, then it really is, I think, incumbent on all of us to do so. You know, for some of you, that's $5 a month. For some of you, it's $125 a month. And for some of you, it might be more or somewhere in between. You know how much you can give to the station. But please take action now at kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931.
And at that $5 a month contribution level, we can thank you with the ubiquitous public radio coffee mug. We have the black ceramic Think mug with the Think logo on it, which you can show all your friends that you support KERA and that you are a fan of Think. That's just $5 a month as a sustaining member or $60 all at once. can check it out online at kera.org or talk to a person when you call 888-694-6931.
Thanks.